You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up at 4:30, a look at Governor Walker's call for lower tuition in UW system schools.
First, have you ever wondered about things like, why do our stomachs sometimes rumble? And how do our hearts know to beat? Is coffee good or bad for you? What about vitamins? These are some of the offbeat questions many of us wish we could find simple answers to.
We have operating instructions for everything from our cars to our TV sets, so why not a manual for operating the human body? Our next guest decided to take a stab at exactly that. James Hamblin is a doctor. He just wrote a guide to owning and operating the human body. He's in the studio with us to answer your questions about how we work, everything you ever wanted to know but were afraid to ask. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Not medical advice, by the way. Just those curious questions. You can also post your question on the Central Time Facebook page.
James Hamblin is a doctor and a senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine. His new book is called If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body. Dr. Hamblin, welcome to Central Time.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, why did you think that we needed a book like this?
Well, these questions are out there, and I write for a magazine and also went to medical school, so I end up hearing a lot of them from friends and family and from readers. So I decided if I put them all in one place, then I could just refer people to that, and we wouldn't have to constantly be addressing them.
And when you started coming out with this idea, did you have people coming out of the woodwork? They're like, oh, interesting idea. Oh, and by the way, dot, dot, dot.
Yes, I started getting even more questions than normal. So I couldn't take them all on here. And this, the premise of the book is a little bit of exaggeration. I make the point in the book that a lot of these things don't have simple answers. Mm-hmm. And I sort of tell stories that explain why we don't know and how it can sometimes be comforting to exist in this space of not knowing everything. And that's okay.
Do you think that sometimes people are, I don't know, a little embarrassed not to know this really basic stuff, like about whether or not everyone drools or why our stomachs rumble?
Yeah. And that was part of the idea, too, is it, maybe it's just me, but in my imagination, a lot of people would enjoy reading a textbook of anatomy and physiology if it was more fun to read, if it was told through stories and through things that we actually wonder and care about. So I sort of reverse engineered a textbook in that way.
And one question that struck me, one I think about a lot, one of the first ones in the book, how do I know if I'm beautiful?
Rob, you're always wondering that about yourself.
Yeah, tossing my hair.
Right. So I wanted to establish at the top sort of standards of the premise of a lot of questions is it normal that, or, you know, an example of beauty that seems to be sort of arbitrary is dimples, which I get into in the book. There's a trend, small trend in dimple surgeries where people
really
are having dimples put into their faces. A relatively quick lunchtime procedure, but not without risks. And there's a period of time where the dimples don't go away. while you're recovering, you have 24/7 dimples, not just while you're smiling. But anyway, I think there's a world out there where people are ashamed of their dimples or have dimple surgeries to try to get rid of their dimples. So a lot of this is kind of arbitrary.
So I have a chin dimple. Do people want those, or is it just the cute cheek ones?
I think you should, if you have it, you should be really happy with it. And if you don't have it, then you should consider them not worth envying. It's one of those things that reminds us that these standards are pretty arbitrary because they don't serve a functional purpose in making us longer lived or better at chewing.
Talking to Dr. James Hamblin, his new book is If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body. He answers a lot of those puzzling, curious questions about how we work. Well, one of those we kind of tease this with is, does everybody drool? I assume so. I've been there. Is that a fact of being human?
Yeah. Again, not something that I learned in medical school, but a lot of people do notice that when they take a nap, they will have drooled, but they don't, when they sleep through the night, don't think that they've drooled. And the idea is that because when you're first falling asleep, you're more likely to drool. You just notice it if you wake up earlier, but you would have done it when you were falling asleep for the night as well.
So the drool is dried is basically what you're telling us.
Yeah, if you're a drooler when you nap, you're a drooler when you sleep.
Well, here's what I want to know about. We talked about this a bit on the show, but we're interested to get your take. What about probiotics? Do they work and should we all be taking them?
Yeah, this is something that we are going to be hearing about over and over again in coming years. And probiotics is a very broad term. You know, we've just recently really come to appreciate that the trillions of microbes that live inside our guts and shape our lives in so many different ways. And so it's very logical to want to optimize those populations. But it turns out there's great variation in the populations between you and the person next to you and what those microbes are like. And the dynamics between so many different entities and what makes a population healthy, we're barely scratching the surface of beginning to understand that, much less to be able to modulate it by throwing in one type of bacterium and assuming that's going to be good for everyone in all conditions. So it's kind of arbitrary right now.
Yeah, this seems like one of those cutting edge things in the world of science where we're realizing that in our guts and elsewhere, there's this ecosystem as complicated as any swamp or jungle.
Yes, exactly. A metaphor that I like is the idea of just going out into the forest with a bag of seeds, and it says, you know, assorted seeds, and assuming that if you take a handful and throw it into the forest, you will be doing good for the ecosystem, or that anything would take at all. And then if it did, that it wouldn't be, you know, that it would be beneficial.
I think I might be merging a couple of your sections together, but I think you get at fiber and the role that that has in the gut biome.
Yeah. So we're getting the sense of how expansive this book is, but if there is one thing that we know to generally increase diversity and favorable ecosystems in the gut, it's a high fiber plant-based diet. People who eat diets that are high in animal products, meat and cheeses, tend to have less gut diversity and more populations of unfavorable bacteria, as far as we know. It's kind of the interesting thing is it's reinforcing this age-old wisdom of eat your fruits and vegetables. We're just now understanding a mechanism as to why that, another way that might be associated with long life and good health.
A related topic that I don't think I knew was related involves the way we greet each other. We might hug, we might kiss. I don't kiss, you know, most people anyway. But a lot of us will shake hands.
Yeah.
Apparently, our microbiomes get in on the game when we do that.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, they do. We trade a lot of microbes just by being social creatures, and to some degree that's good. We also know that that is how contagions, cold and flu season, those things are spread that way. Especially in hospitals, and I've been an advocate of this, to do a fist bump, especially during cold and flu seasons, as a sign of respect for someone. We're still understanding how it is that we transmit good population and benefit from being social while not transmitting these pathogens that end up incapacitating us.
And I'm going to ask this next question on behalf of Rob, who has a bit of a stomach rumble. I'm sure all of listeners are familiar with it. So does everyone have a stomach rumble? Why does it happen?
Yeah. So it has to do with your stomach is constantly sort of like a snake swallowing a rodent. It's contracting and squeezing so that it can move food through from one end to the next. So when there's air inside of that, to various degrees, depending on how much we all tend to swallow air and how often our gastric and colonic muscles contract, you'll hear more or less squeezing in some people, and there's not a lot you can do about it. But it doesn't mean it's not bad.
Or is it? It could be bad, though, right?
Well, it could be bad socially if you find it embarrassing. But again, this is one of those things that if we choose to find it embarrassing, right, then it's bad. But we don't have to choose.
So if there's like a colleague who draws attention to it, that's when it becomes a problem, is what I'm hearing.
Yes.
I think it's very melodic.
Totally hypothetical.
I consider it the third voice of the show. It's lovely. We're talking right now about how weird and wonderful the human body is with Dr. James Hamblin, senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine. His new book is called If Our Bodies Could Talk. Talk, a guide to operating and maintaining a human body.
And you can join in with your burning question about the quirks of the human body at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You've heard some of the kinds of questions we've been tackling. You probably have that nagging thing that you've been thinking about, maybe embarrassed to ask, or you just didn't know who to ask. Well, Dr. Hamlin might be the person. If he doesn't have an answer, it could appear in the sequel. We are talking about how quirky and sometimes befuddling our human bodies are, and this is your chance to ask that question you've always wanted to ask, but maybe not known who to ask at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about how much sleep is enough? Whether wearing tight pants will give you varicose veins? Why breath smells bad in the morning? Is there something you're curious about in the way we work? Not looking for medical questions here. Those curiosity-type questions. Call 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR.
James Hamlin stays with us. He's a doctor and senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine. His new book is called If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body.
And we'll go to our callers. Chris is on the line in Sparta. Chris, hi.
Hi, I have a curiosity that I would love to hear an answer to, and that is, are eye boogers really microscopic worm poop?
So eye boogers, the stuff that collects, you know, kind of in the corner of our eye there, is it microscopic worm poop is the question on the table, Dr. Hamlin.
Is that really a misconception? I haven't heard it before.
Have you heard this, Chris?
I had heard it, so I keep telling my kid that. I don't know if I'm lying.
No, it's not. It's a mixture of tears and the oils that are all over our faces, and they just accumulate there when our eyes aren't constantly blinking to wash things away while we're asleep. I mean, but you know, I need to caveat everything that this is the best that we know as yet, and anything is theoretically possible.
And Chris, I hope you're not using this as some sort of behavioral technique. Like, if you misbehave in this way, the eye worms will come back.
Oh, no.
Okay, good. Just wanted to be clear on that.
Scary.
All right, Chris, thanks a lot. And we're going to go next to Becky in Verona. Becky, hi.
Hi. I know we've been hearing a lot about how good the good bacteria is in our guts. And I wondered, when you have a colonoscopy and you have to drink all of that gunk that cleans everything out, does that get rid of the good bacteria and do you have to start over again?
Uh-huh. Thanks, Becky.
I know that's a great question. And I think there will be studies on exactly how that affects everything in the future, since, you know, a lot of this is still relatively new to our understanding. But it certainly doesn't clear out everything. It clears out all the macroscopic material that's in there, but it doesn't eliminate all of the bacteria. It might have some effects, but we also know that colonoscopies are one of the clearly proven ways to prevent cancers from becoming deadly. So no recommendations to be worried about the colonoscopy preparations at the moment.
Becky, thanks for that call. We heard from Paul on email. Paul writes, coffee's going to kill us. No wait, it extends our life. Lipitor should be in the water supply. No wait, it can cause severe cramping and cognitive problems. What's the approach, Paul asks, to dealing with these changing perspectives and fads in popular culture and sometimes also in the medical culture?
That is the perfect question, I think. That's sort of the idea behind the book. It does seem like we are constantly hearing new things, and part of that is, you know, we in the media are responsible for that. You know, what makes a good story? The idea that you're learning something that's totally upending what we knew before. And in fact, as a journalist, that sort of story comes along only probably a few times in your career when you really think that something is completely changing before your eyes. And so it's about taking everything in context of what you already knew. Each new study, each new piece of data that you learn about is part of this ongoing evolving blob of scientific knowledge that you're adding to. And it sort of slowly swerves around, but it doesn't make these radical left-hand turns every day.
A swirling blob of knowledge.
Yes, yes.
This is Central Time. Swirling blob of knowledge.
A good book title it would have been.
Yeah. All right, thanks for that question. We'll go next to Deborah in Brown Deer. Deborah, hi.
Hello. I have osteoarthrosis. That's what it said on the diagnosis. In both hips. I have a really bad right hip. And I swear I can predict the weather. So I'm curious if there's any not scientific, like, findings that you know, your body hurts more when it's going to rain or when the barometric pressure is up.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. That's something I can't explain is outside of my expertise, but it's such a common observation that I would really be surprised if there were no foundation for it.
Right. I mean, people have their trick knee or trick ankle. I have my trick sinuses that tell me when a pressure front is coming in. Yeah, that is one I've always wondered about and never known if it was true.
Yeah. I have to say that I've heard it so much anecdotally that I'd be surprised if there were no data on it. That said, this is the kind of research that gets, when research funding is limited, gets kind of pushed to the back burner.
Thanks a lot for that call, Deborah. We'll go next to Brett on the line in Janesville. Brett, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to ask about, Brett?
When you pop joints like your knuckles or knees or back, what's actually popping? I've heard it could be things like buildup of diffused nitrogen or the bones actually popping in or out of joint.
Yeah, it shouldn't be the bones actually popping in or out of the joint. If you're actually, I mean, it could be if you're actually dislocating your finger, you'd know it. So yeah, it seems to be that it's small bubbles that are making a popping noise when you do it. And I have seen small, sort of inconclusive studies that doing it with great frequency could contribute to earlier degeneration of those joints. But I haven't heard anybody seriously like worry about people doing it.
Man, oh man, what do I want to do right now? I don't do that frequently.
No,
I do crack my knuckles.
Don't do it 24/7. Just like anything, that tends to be the advice.
Moderation.
All right, Brett, thank you for that call. And we go next to Nathan as we talk to Dr. James Hamblin right now. He's the author of the book, If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body. You can call us at 800-642-1234. Nathan's next in Walworth. Nathan, hi.
Hi. I was just wondering, why do we get hiccups and how do I get rid of them?
Yeah, some of them are not really fun. Sometimes I feel like there's some mild hiccups and then hiccups extreme, which are just really unpleasant.
Yeah. They're great for radio.
Yeah.
Oh, that must be debilitating. Yeah, there are people who have serious disorders where the hiccups make life almost unlivable. So, yeah, also something that I think is outside of anything that I touch on in the book, because I kind of limited it to questions where I could see a clinical or worldly reason to that this might affect our health. And so the nice thing is that there shouldn't be, unless you have these intractable hiccups where you can't sleep or can't, say, do your job on the radio, that there shouldn't be anything to worry about, and there nothing more than a curiosity, but one of the many.
Nathan, thanks for the call. Okay, I think we're gonna go here. I can go here, right?
Why don't you go there?
Okay,
this
Gregory.
This is your area.
This is my, Gregory on Twitter writes, where do farts go when you hold them in, parentheses, asking for a friend?
Ah. Well, they certainly don't go anywhere except into the colon. If there's air in there, it'll have to come out eventually. Mm-hmm. But it might wait until the next time you, you know, are in the restroom. Having a bowel movement.
So they don't just magically dissipate or disappear. Gregory.
Right. They might sort of move back through the colon, and the urge might pass, but eventually that air will come out.
Rob, you ask, we seek answers.
Is there anything else you want to ask in that vein, Rob? I know this is your big moment.
There's a running joke, little pranks I play on my colleagues here of changing our scripts to include that particular effort.
Yes. Well,
that's the behind-the-scenes moment.
It
Rob's maturity here at Central Time.
Well, kind of in a not quite the same vein, but I want to ask about tight pants, otherwise known as skinny jeans. Are they bad for us, or are they just maybe a fashion faux pas for some people?
Yeah, I write about that in the book. There was this big story about a woman in Australia about a year and a half ago that sort of went everywhere, all over the news, that she had to have emergency hospitalization because she lost feeling in her feet after wearing tight pants and had to be hospitalized and it ultimately recovered. But the takeaway was, you know, maybe they're dangerous, and that's not a serious concern. And if anything, actually, there's a history of therapeutic uses of tight pants during in trauma victims, where you bring a patient into the emergency room who's had trauma, and compression pants are actually applied to stop bleeding. So there's many sides to that story.
Interesting. Well, tight pants, not a big story in my life. But getting back to Rob-related questions, I've got a large-ish Adam's apple, and you write about, this is something people have asked you, why do men have these Adam's apples? Women, not so much.
Right, right. And it is just this, a structure of the cartilage of the larynx, which we all have, and inside that are vocal cords. So during puberty, the cartilage of males tends to grow more, grow outwards, and we get these longer, thicker vocal cords when voices tend to drop, just like the bass notes on a guitar tend to be deeper at that point. But we all have that structure. It's just this spectrum of size.
And a practical one as we get ready to wrap up. So deodorant, you're traveling, you don't have deodorant, but you do have hand sanitizer. Is that going to do the trick?
You must have read that in the book. That isn't something that most people have tried in my experience, but I have.
Right, I have not tried this.
So the active ingredient in most deodorants is an antibacterial. And so, yeah, we're constantly changing that underarm ecosystem and trying to shift it away from the odor-producing bacteria and killing them off every single day. So the ones that the bacterial antibacterials that are in hand sanitizer do kill those bacteria, but in my experience, the effect tends to not last as long as a formulated thing that's meant to be a deodorant for a period of more than an hour or so.
Well, Dr. Hamlin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Dr. James Hamlin, senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine, and we're talking about his new book. It's called If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body. If you want to hear more, you can catch James Hamlin tonight at 7 o'clock at the Madison Public Library Central Branch. His talk is free and open to the public.
The words, I'm sorry, can be seen as the two most powerful words in the English language, but they can also be the toughest to say.
That's according to Harriet Lerner. She's a nationally recognized psychotherapist and relationship expert, known for her work on the psychology of women and family relationships. And she's the author of 12 other books, including The Dance of Anger.
And her new book is Why Won't You Apologize? Healing Big Betrayals and Everyday Hurts. She joins us now. Harriet, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here.
What makes apologies such powerful and sometimes complicated things?
Well, first of all, it's so important. We're all connected. We all screw up. We all unwittingly hurt other people just as we're hurt by them. So the need to give and receive apologies is with us until our very last breath. And if done well, the apology is deeply healing. And if the apology is absent or we muck it up, it actually can put a crack in the very foundation of the relationship or even end it. So it's a really important topic, and it's very important to get it right. It's very easy to get it wrong.
Let's get into how to make a bad apology, because you spent some time on that in the book. What are some of the ways that we faux apologize, that we say things that sound like an apology but really don't convey that message sincerely?
The most common way is with the word but. I'm sorry I yelled at you, but you provoked me. I'm sorry I forgot to call you on your birthday, but I was totally snowed under with work. It doesn't matter if what you say after the but is true. The but makes the apology false. It always indicates some kind of excuse or rationalization. So the first thing would be to get your but out of your apology, and no pun intended. And then the second most common way is when we apologize for the other person's feelings and reactions rather than apologizing directly for what we said or did or didn't say or do. For example, I'm sorry that you were upset that I corrected your stories at the party. That is not an apology. There's no accountability there. So a real apology would be, I'm sorry I corrected your stories at the party. you've told me that you don't like that. I was totally wrong, and I won't do it again. And the list goes on.
You give a lot of examples throughout the book, anecdotes from people you know, yourself and others. One common thing that seems to come up a lot is that often in an interaction gone wrong between two people, there's some offense on both sides, some harm caused by both parties and received by both parties. And it seems like that is one of the toughest situations to sort out an apology, because we might have the sense of justice. Well, if I'm going to apologize, maybe they should apologize too.
Exactly. For example, in my marriage to Steve, I like to apologize for exactly my part of the problem, as I calculated, of course, which is never more than 47%. And I expect Steve to apologize for his part of the problem exactly as I calculate it. And we often don't do the same math. And that is simply one very common apology problem, where each person wants the other to apologize first because they're vying for the position of the one who's more to, you know, who's more to blame, who started it. And it really does take a lot of maturity to care enough about the relationship to be the first to accept responsibility for our part of the problem without a hint of evasion, excuse-making, or blaming, even when the other person can't do the same.
Or even maybe you make your end of the apology in a magnanimous spirit and then eagerly leave the table open for them to take their turn, and maybe they do or maybe they don't.
Right, exactly. Maybe they do or maybe they don't, but, you know, we always stand on higher ground when we are able to be our best selves and not just act in reaction to the other person's immaturity.
Talking to Harriet Lerner, author of the new book, Why Won't You Apologize? Talking about the power of saying I'm sorry and some of the roadblocks to doing it. I want to talk about a couple of extreme cases, Harriet. First of all, the person who never apologizes, who never admits culpability, wrongdoing to anyone. Often you write the person who does the most harm to begin with. How, if we're the person on the receiving end of that person's treatment, how can we approach that?
Well, first of all, most of us can apologize, and we have trouble in particular situations. For example, many people have trouble apologizing in a relationship where they feel overly criticized. There are too many criticisms and little corrections, and it's hard then to apologize when we should in that kind of situation. But we'll apologize with other people and in other situations. The entrenched non-apologizer is a person who walks on a tightrope of defensiveness above a huge canyon of low self-esteem. In order to apologize for a really serious hurt, we need to stand on a great, big, solid foundation of self-worth. And from that higher vantage point, we can look out at our mistakes and apologize, because we can see our mistakes as part of a much bigger, more complex, ever-changing picture of who we are as a human being. But people who do serious harm stand on a small, rickety platform of self-worth, and they're unable to get it. They're unable to see the harm they've done, because to do so would threaten them to collapse into an identity of worthlessness or shame. And no one can tolerate that. So it's very important for those people who want to confront a serious harm, say with a parent or a family member to understand that the response you get has nothing to do with how much that person loves you. What it has to do with is the amount of self-worth that that person has to draw upon. So it's important to understand, if you're opening up a conversation with someone who's going to wrap themselves in defensiveness and minimization and denial, that if you're going to speak, speak because you need to hear the sound of your own voice saying what you know to be true. Because the apology that you're longing for may not be coming, you know, not now or not ever.
We're talking to psychotherapist Harriet Lerner. Her newest book is Why Won't You Apologize? Healing Big Betrayals and Everyday Hurts.
And we want to hear from you. What's important to you when you're getting an apology? Do you have trouble bringing yourself to say I'm sorry? And do you have a method of apologizing that's worked well for you? Has a meaningful apology helped maybe repair a relationship in your life? You can tell us about it at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about the value of a good apology with Harriet Lerner. She's a nationally recognized psychotherapist, and her newest book is called Why Won't You Apologize? Healing Big Betrayals and Everyday Hurts.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think makes for a good and effective apology, and a bad one for that matter? Do you have a way that you have apologized in the past? Has a relationship in your life been saved by a good apology from you to someone else, or vice versa? Do you feel the need to say sorry to someone in your life? You're struggling to find the right words. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Harriet, we've talked some about what makes a bad apology. People have come to you asking the question, I've had a rift in a relationship in my life. I know it's at least partly my own fault. What do you tell them about how to make that step and make a good, solid, effective apology?
Well, I probably wouldn't give them instructions, but I would certainly be very interested in their capacity to really listen to the hurt or angry party that they want to apologize for. That's really the hardest part. You know, we're wired for defensiveness. And what the hurt party really wants to hear is not just the words, I'm sorry, which, by the way, can be a quick way out of the conversation. Like, I told you 5 times I was sorry about the affair. Why do you keep bringing it up? What the hurt party really needs, if we're going to give a healing, heartfelt apology, is they need us to listen. That we need to say, yes, I get it. Your feelings make sense. I screwed up. I want you to know that this is not going to happen again. But that doesn't have meaning if we haven't really listened. So maybe the most important thing I would want such a person to know is what I just said, that no apology will have meaning if we haven't listened carefully to the hurt party's anger and pain, which is so difficult to do because we're wired for defensiveness.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Sharon on the line in Walworth. Sharon, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Sharon?
Thank you for taking my call. I'm actually a first-time caller. I have a question. I have an 11-year-old son. I just recently divorced. I have 3 little ones. I have 11, 9, and 7. I also have an older one, but he's not a part of the divorce. Anyway, my 11-year-old, he's very passive and accommodating, but he constantly is apologizing for everything. If he sees me upset, or if he sees somebody else upset, or just any circumstance, he's always like, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. And I just was wondering, I tell him, you know, I say, you know, son, you don't have to apologize unless you've done something wrong or made a mistake. You know, you don't need to apologize for everything. And I'm constantly trying to reassure him and affirm him and love on him. And, you know, I just was wondering, what do you say about that? I mean, how do I convince him or guide him and direct him and stop apologizing and being so passive and not standing up for himself and just honestly taking the burden for other people's mistakes as well?
Sharon, thanks for the call. And Harriet, I know this is something you might spend time with a client on, talk a patient for a long time, but generally for a young person who's over-apologizing, it sounds like, do you have some general words of advice?
I would say, Sharon, to not worry about it. And, of course, post-divorce and post-divorce lasts a long time. You know, a lot of behaviors of children are going to be very exaggerated. And it sounds like you have done a very good job letting him know, you know, that he really doesn't need to apologize for something unless he really has done something that he thinks is wrong. And since you've told him that, and you've told him with clarity, I would defocus on it. I would not be concerned about his behaviors. I would stop correcting him about the over-apologizing. Because sometimes the more we focus on a child's behavior that we believe is problematic, it actually will exacerbate the behavior. So I wouldn't worry about it. And what I would try to do is to keep the lines of communication open around the issues of the divorce. You know, what's the hardest thing for him about the divorce? And to be very clear with him, and of course all the kids, that he's not responsible for anything about the divorce, that he didn't cause it, he can't fix it, that his job is to have the best relationship with you and his dad that he can have, because it's possible that the over-apologizing relates to, you know, kids often unconsciously feel responsible for everything that occurs in the family. So I wouldn't worry about this. I just wouldn't worry about it, Sharon.
Sharon, good luck to you and your family, and thanks so much for making that first call. We'll go next to Rob on the line in Madison. Rob, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. How are you guys doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about Rob?
Well, I'm a part-time chaplain, and a lot of what I do is I deal with people who either themselves or their families have to come to a point of forgiveness as a person is reaching the end of life. And I found that there could be kind of a paradox between apology and forgiveness, in that in order to achieve the latter, the former can be either a great first step or it can be a meddling factor. And, you know, I guess I would like to, if there's a way that I can professionally avoid the meddlesome apology to achieve forgiveness, I'd like to be able to do that. Does the guest have any advice for achieving forgiveness with or without apology?
Harriet, any thoughts?
Well, in my book, Why Won't You Apologize, Rob, I have a chapter called You Need to Forgive and Other Lies That Hurt You, because there are many routes to finding peace of mind without forgiveness. And I think that when people believe that there can be no peace or healing without forgiveness, and this is the only path to a life not mired down in bitterness or hate, it leads to problems. Forgiveness is not always a cheap gift. For some people, it has to be earned. And a colleague of mine, Janice Abrams Spring, has written a good book about forgiveness that I like. And one of the points she makes is that you don't necessarily restore your humanity when you forgive a non-apologetic offender. he restores his humanity when he works to earn your forgiveness. So I don't mean to sound like a big meanie, Rob. I have nothing against forgiveness. But when forgiveness is touted as the only path to healing, when people are told that they're a less loving and whole person if they don't, if there are certain things they do not forgive, I see that as problematic. So I'm actually very interested in the forgiveness issue. And if you read my chapters, I would be very interested in hearing, because you are a chaplain, I'd be very interested in hearing your reaction.
Rob, thanks for that call. We're talking to Harriet Lerner about her new book, Why Won't You Apologize? Time for another caller. Terry is on the line in Green Bay. Terry, hi.
Hi, guys. I wanted to chime in. I am a single parent of two teenage daughters, and occasionally, through providing guidance and discipline to both of my daughters, occasionally I will slip up and maybe say something that I realize momentarily later that, or moments later, that I may have said the wrong thing and hurt their feelings. And it might be easy for some people to do that and to walk away and not be concerned about the child's feelings. I find myself realizing that I have to quickly react to that error and apologize or reframe the comment that I made, which might have been hurtful. So that's my advice. If there are any parents out there, for me, this has been something that I realize is the right way to go.
Terry, thanks for the call. Harriet, we're just about out of time. But thoughts on making that apology sooner rather than later?
It actually does not matter very often. I work with parents who have said to their adult children, you know, I've been thinking about some things that happened 10 years ago around the time of, you know, the divorce. And I actually have been thinking that I was not very available to you at the time of the divorce. And I'm wondering what that was like for you, because I actually think about that all the time. In other words, it is never too late to open up a conversation and apologize to a family member for something that might have happened decades ago.
We'll leave it there. Harriet, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
We've been talking to Harriet Lerner. She's a psychotherapist, a relationship expert. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Why Won't You Apologize? Healing Big Betrayals and Everyday Hurts. If you go over to the Central Time Facebook page, you can find a link to some information about her book. And while you're there, you can share your thoughts on apologies. What makes a good apology? What makes a bad apology? And is there a time in your life where an apology made a difference, helped patch over some problems, or would have made a difference? Is there somebody you still maybe think you ought to make that apology to? Again, find more info, share your thoughts, maybe your experiences over at the Central Time Facebook page.